Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. It's going to be a solo effort today, and we're going to talk about three subjects. First, we're going to look at how I scout the three different roles for wide receivers: split ends, flankers, slots, and then also talk about, you know, what I'm looking at for the 2021 season in terms of the improvements I've made or the changes I've made for my evaluation process for quarterbacks. And what I want to kind of cover that is how that process has changed so that you can find that invisible thread that ties skills together in an intuitive, compelling, and productive way, and why all that's important. And then we're going to wrap up the show with early projections that stand out for me for the 2020 NFL season. You know, at footballguys.com, I will be putting out rankings after Memorial Day, and those rankings are rooted in projections that I do. And so I'll be covering some of the players that I think stood out, either positive or negative for me. I think there's about 7 to 10 of them that I'll cover today. And you'll see some of the projections that I do in gut check columns, you know, during this early part of the summer. And maybe if Dwayne McFarland's able to have some time, you know, it depends on his schedule right now. He's been snowed under. We may do a projection series once again, like we did last summer. That was a big hit with the RSP Cast. Before we get into it, though, you know, once again, the 2020 Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication is now available for download. The pre-draft and the post-draft and the newsletter that people get with it will be out beginning in June, and that will have an updated set of rankings for the past 3 years of rookie classes, which is a really nice, you know, add-on for those who play in dynasty leagues. And speaking of people who play in dynasty leagues, a lot of people I know who at first get the post-draft, they're usually, if they're just like pure give me the answers dynasty players, I often get emails from them and they're like, hey man, what if I just bought the RSP post-draft for, you know, for that price alone? What do you think about selling it separately? And I've always resisted doing that, and they've always been kind of puzzled. And I would say to them, listen, just in a few years, write me back and let me know whether that's still the case for you as you're playing, because I think you're going to find the pre-draft as valuable, if not more valuable, than the post-draft in, you know, 3-4 years from now. And I didn't hear from them. And then in 2-3 years, I'd get an email back from a number of them, and they'd say, yeah, you know, I play Dynasty a lot, and I really, when you told me that, I thought, well, you know, the post-draft has that cheat sheet, and it weighs the difference between the ADP of drafts that you've studied after the NFL draft, and compares where you've re-ranked these players and gives me this sweet spot. So if, you know, you rated Patrick Mahomes as your number one quarterback, you were able to help me get him at a value, because while you rated him number one, you showed me in that cheat sheet where you could wait to get him, how many picks you could wait to get him, or how many picks you'd have to move up to get another guy in order to get him at the value that he's at. And that was so helpful, especially with all the depth chart analysis that you also do in the fit-based stuff. But then these players started getting cut or traded, or somebody got hurt, and then a new guy worked his way up the depth chart. Guys that I didn't even know who they were. And then I'd go back and look at the Rookie Scouting Portfolio pre-draft and start to see that you did as much work on the, you know, on the 20th ranked guy as I see other places that they do on the 5th ranked guy. And, you know, that in-depth look at those players helped me really get a good portrait of what they could do, what they couldn't do, what they might be able to learn, what type of scenarios that, you know, in terms of schemes that they might land in that could make them better or more productive than what maybe their ranking looks like. And I realized that pre-draft is actually more of a dynasty look. The post-draft is actually pretty good for redraft and for the way most people play dynasty, which is, you know, that first 1 to 2 years, whereas the pre-draft kind of covers that longer term where players start to drift to other teams. So again, for $21.95, you get the pre-draft, you get the post-draft, you get the newsletter from June through December, and you get 3 rankings updates during that time from the past 3 years of draft classes, as well as previews from the 2021 class and conversations or notes about how these 2020 rookies are doing in camp, if we have a camp this year, you know, depending on how everything's going to play out. But, you know, you've got some exclusive content that comes on with that newsletter as well, all for $21.95, and a portion of those proceeds go to Darkness to Light, an organization dedicated to preventing sexual abuse of children, as well as addressing it appropriately and teaching people in the community to address it appropriately when it unfortunately happens. It's a reality, and it's something that we need to be able to, as adults and community leaders and people who are children are counting on, to be able to provide the care that's necessary when this is reported so that we don't compound the issue. So again, $21.95 at mattwaldmanrsp.com. I can tell you that most people who get it for the first time either email me with just pleasant shock of how much they get and how good the quality of the content is, or they're slapping themselves, or they tell me that they want to slap themselves for being on the fence for the past 2, 3, 4 years, and they finally got it, and they're thinking, why didn't I get this years ago when I first saw it and thought it was appealing? So again, it's the best thing I do. If you want to support the podcast, you want to support, you know, what Mark Schofield does with the art, you know, with the free content that we do, as well as the YouTube channel, you know, all I'm asking for you to do is buy the best thing that I do, which is the book. No ads, no nothing, just straight content other than this little 2-3 minute thing that I did right now. So let's get started. Receiver roles, what we look for from split end flankers and slots. You know, I think, you know, what's interesting about that is oftentimes you don't see much of a differentiation in those positions when we talk about scouting. You know, when you look at scouting guides, you're not seeing some clear-cut way that says, let's talk about the differences between these three positions. And a lot of it is because there are players who can play 2 to 3 of these roles pretty well. And if you make too clear of a delineation between the three, what can happen is that you can miss out on, you know, what makes a player valuable. And as a result of that, you kind of eliminate things that you don't want to eliminate when you're evaluating them. For instance, if you want to say that a split end needs to have more release skills against press than a slot player, that's understandable. But at the same time, there are very, you know, high-end slot players still have to face press coverage at times. And it's going to be important that they can beat it, especially if it's a Monday night affair. They're the top player, you know, on their offense, and the team's going to, you know, take Xavier Rhodes or Patrick Peterson, and they're going to, you know, put one of their best players on him and press him hard to try and keep him off the line, you know, from getting off the line easily. Defenses do that. So, you know, we don't necessarily want to, you know, some of the things I'm going to tell you are tendencies, but they're not necessarily like hard stop type issues. So, for instance, with the split end, you know, normally we think about the split end, he's the guy that lines up, you know, on the line of scrimmage or is closest to the line of scrimmage. He's the one that's most likely to get pressed early or have a tight man-to-man. A lot of the routes that he's going to run are often the deeper routes, the defense, the stretching, the field stretching routes, the vertical plays. And you want a guy usually that has a lot of speed, someone that if he isn't pressed, that he can often beat a defensive back straight up. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's always the case. You can have a split end who can be a really tall guy, a long striding guy who may not have that classic timed high-end speed, but he has build-up speed and he has the ability to stop fast and run precise routes, and he can win above the rim. So he's the type of guy that can leap and win that way. And if you have a system where you know that your quarterback can make those types of trust throws, your receiver can get open in a more physical fashion with build-up speed or with really good route running and winning in tight coverage, that guy can work at split end. It's not the most conventional thing, but it's possible. So split end, normally you're looking at a guy that, you know, most teams are going to look for a guy who does have that speed, someone who can run those linear routes very well, and then someone who also has that skill to be able to defeat press coverage or just outrun tight man coverage when it doesn't get physical. You know, the flanker is more of a guy that oftentimes you're looking that he's going to play, you know, anywhere between 1 to 3, maybe even 5 yards off the line of scrimmage at times. And he's used a little bit more often as the player who's going to be counted on for yards after the catch. Because, one, you're trying to line, you're lining him up in a way where he's not going to get pressed, where you want a good route runner. You know, obviously he's going to need to be a good route runner so that he can compound that separation with good route running that he has early on, because he's not going to be pressed as often. They still get pressed, but because you're off the line, you're still going to get a little bit of an opportunity to be able to do some work to get earlier separation. And then it's also about the routes that work across the field, or routes that, you know, that often can work back to the quarterback and allow the receiver to really, you know, catch the ball and be able to get yards after the catch. You want your guy, your guy who can be, you know, your punt return type of player in the open field. Oftentimes you can look at them as kind of more of a flanker in many respects. Tim Brown was an excellent flanker way back in the day for the Oakland Raiders, you know, who was a great punt returner. You could put him in at that spot. But then again, you could think about when Tim Brown, an aging Tim Brown and an aging Jerry Rice both played together, and they both switched off, you know, at flanker and split end. And Tim Brown certainly had the speed to play split end. I mean, this was a 4-3 guy way back in the day. As he got older, maybe not so much, but with good route running, ability to work against press, you know, these were guys that were able to get it done. But the flanker is probably more often your guy that, you know, is going to be able to catch passes, you know, maybe in the short and intermediate ranges of the field. With play action, they'll probably be used a little bit more on the deep end. Again, this is general, not necessarily the overall rule, but you're looking at guys who where maybe press coverage isn't as important in terms of them defeating it. I mean, it still can be an important thing, but split end is probably a little bit more of the highest priority. Flanker is maybe slight, you know, kind of more of a medium priority. And you're going to understand too that when it comes to, you know, getting deep, split end, it's very important for them to be able to get deep. With a flanker, it's a nice to have, but it may not always be a must. You know, and then also after the catch skill, blocking. You're going to want a flanker to be able to block well too. Someone that you can kind of work towards the line, be on the wing sometimes, be able to help out with outside linebacker or a double team. You know, you want your flankers to be able to block in that role as well. So there's some, you know, some differences there. So with the slot, you know, to me, you can almost classify the slot as both small and big in terms of, you know, in terms of the role that's there. You know, with a small slot player, oftentimes you can have guys who may be ultra quick, but not that fast down the field. Think of Julian Edelman and Wes Welker. They weren't guys that were going to beat you deep very often one-on-one against tight man coverage. Very rarely would they win that type of a battle or be counted to win on that type of battle unless it was an absolute mismatch that they created or some sort of slow developing play that could trick the defender on them and get them to, you know, bite on something that the quarterback was doing. But you know, and then you have other guys like a Steve Smith who could play in the slot if you needed him to, who was, you know, had split end speed, you know, and flanker ability in terms of what he could do after the catch. So, you know, so the slot, you know, has a wide range of things that you could, you know, of physical types that you could be looking at just from the small slot itself. You know, KJ Hamler will probably play in the slot, and he's a super fast, super quick guy. And then you'll see Jerry Jeudy, his teammate, play in the slot as well. But I think what will happen is that you'll see at times what may happen is that you'll see where maybe the Broncos might put KJ Hamler at split end, put Jerry Jeudy at flanker, or Jerry Jeudy in the slot, and then put Courtland Sutton at flanker, whereas Courtland Sutton may often be the split end when Jerry Jeudy is the flanker in just two receiver sets and Hamler's off the field. But Hamler can play split end and slot, and then I think you'd put Jeudy at flanker or slot, and then you'd put Courtland Sutton most likely at either split end or flanker, and then even sometimes they might use him as a big slot, depending on what they want to do. Maybe they want to match him up where they know with the formation that they might get a matchup with a linebacker, and they could put Courtland Sutton on a linebacker and let him run by him on, say, a corner route or a seam route. You know, you'd see that happen with a guy like Kenny Golladay early in his career, that he'd earn some fun matchups against a safety and just blow by him for a 50-yard, you know, catch up the seam. So oftentimes, you know, teams try to confuse by, you know, taking what the general rule is of who's one role and then putting him in a different role so that they can get that matchup based on the theory of how the defense is going to cover it. And if the defense doesn't make the adjustment, then you end up with the mismatch. That's why that kind of works the way it does, is that the defense also knows that your split end is typically this one type of guy, your flanker is typically another type of guy, your slot's typically like a third type of guy, and maybe they're feeling like, well, we can get a linebacker, you know, we can get a weak side linebacker to cover the slot man in this particular look and have the safety play behind it, or we can put a safety on this guy, you know, one-on-one, and it should be okay because he can play over the top and still be able to, you know, limit the guy in terms of tackling him just at the catch point on a shallower route. Whereas what ends up happening is that a savvy offense will end up placing a guy who can burn that safety, and the safety's in a whole world of hurt, and it breaks the play wide open. So, you know, shorts, you know, you have your small slot and then your big slot, and your big slot's kind of, you know, you don't see as much of that, but we've seen a little bit more lately. You know, Juju Smith-Schuster is a good example of a big slot player. So is Michael Thomas. You know, Adam Thielen would work in that way. Cooper Kupp even is a big slot in a lot of regards. And these are guys, again, that have really strong route skills, may not have top-end speed of a split end. Maybe even when they're used as a flanker, while they can do that role, if they're matched up against a top end press corner, they may struggle to get off press. So that may be difficult for them to win those one-on-one matchups all the time. But when you can put them, you know, in a big slot role, oftentimes you can see them against safeties or against where they can beat the safety with speed. But if they face, say, a nickel corner or a dime corner, not dime defensive back, who may not be quite as fast or quite as physical, then these guys can also, you know, maybe be able to out-physical them or be able to beat them with a route or be able to rebound over them. So what you're really getting here is, you know, ways that you want to use mismatches, what your quarterback does well. Does your quarterback throw the corner route well? Does he throw the flag route well or the deep crosser well? Does he have issues throwing, you know, certain routes that, say, Deshaun Watson, Lamar Jackson, Joe Burrow, and Baker Mayfield maybe have certain problems throwing, depending on, you know, and they all have different ones that they may throw well or not. But, like, I could say that Burrow, Jackson, and Watson have some difficulty making the power throws, the deep comebacks, the opposite hash outs, you know, the hook routes, the, you know, those types of plays that are more on the, you know, that require a lot of velocity as opposed to a lot of arc. And oftentimes the receivers that you want to pick for your team match the type of routes that you want your quarterbacks to throw. You know, Justin Jefferson, you know, is a route runner who can probably do a number of different things for you. But again, you know, let me think of another guy. Like, say, Michael Thomas, you can certainly run him on quick hitting slants that pretty much every quarterback can throw. You can have him run deep outs, but again, he's going to be facing tight man coverage and he's not, you know, extremely fast. It's going to be a tight coverage play. But if you can have him running routes where maybe he can win with a nice move and be able to work with leverage where his size is more to his advantage, like that corner route, then you can throw more of those in the vertical end of the field without having to load up the, you know, in terms of arm velocity that maybe some of the quarterbacks don't have, or they don't throw with the same level of accuracy. So, you know, those are some of the differences. You know, so when I'm looking at players and I say this guy's more of a split end, we'll talk about some examples of that just so that, you know, it can be a little bit easier for people to understand why I may say this guy's a split end versus, you know, another guy being a flanker. You know, we'll talk about, say, Jerry Jeudy. Jerry Jeudy, when you look at his size and you look at his speed, he has more build-up speed than he has instant acceleration. His acceleration isn't as good as his change of direction quickness and his long speed. So when you're thinking about split ends, you want a split end to be a guy who within the first three steps can beat that man who's playing tight to him if that man doesn't get his hands on him. And even if he does, he can be, you know, he's either big enough or savvy enough to be able to work free from that. Now, Jeudy has some of that, but he wins so much with change of direction quickness and with, you know, with build-up speed that he's trying, you know, he's going to take a little bit more time to get up to that top speed, which means that really if you're going to use Jerry Jeudy to win deep, you're probably going to be doing it off of a double move. You're probably going to do it off some sort of play action or some sort of route that works across the width of the field where it's easier to run away from a defender than vertically. And so that's why Jerry Jeudy is more of a flanker or a slot player than he is a split end. Whereas you can look at a player like Denzel Mims and you can see his height and his top speed and his top acceleration and the way he uses his hands and the way that he can win the ball above the rim. And you realize that that guy is better fit, is well suited for being a split end. And of course, a split end can play flanker too, especially if they can run after the catch, if they can block, if they have, you know, some of those skills as well. But, you know, it's harder to find a good split end, I think, than it is to find a good flanker in a lot of regards. So, you know, Mims has that role of being able to be a flanker, or excuse me, a split end. Laviska Shenault. Laviska Shenault's a good example of a guy who's, you know, has that split end ability to win above the rim. I think he's going to show that he has the speed, even though he ran a 4.58 or 4.52 in the 40. He was doing it with a sports hernia. So, you know, I think he probably runs in the low 4.5s or high 4.4s, maybe even the mid 4.4s. And if he does that, that's, you know, for his size and strength, he could be a split end, but he's probably best used as a flanker. You know, ultimately, I think that's where you're going to look at a guy in terms of what he can do for you after the catch. You know, he can still run some of these timing routes for you that flankers run. But he's also a guy that, you know, you're going to be able to count on him in the short and intermediate ranges of the field. And then he can blow by you with a double move or with some work off of play action to get deep. He's also good for the slot. We also know that we've seen him in the backfield, and he's big enough and hardy enough that maybe we can even use him occasionally as a wing back, a guy who's kind of more of an H-back on certain looks. So you'll see that. I mean, even Robert Woods gets used as an H-back on occasion, and he's not nearly as big or hardy as Shenault is. But those are some examples. You know, you look at a guy like Jalen Reagor. Jalen Reagor is an interesting setup because you can look at him and say, well, he's fast enough to probably be a split end. He's small enough and quick enough and his skills after the catch that he could probably be used as a flanker or a slot player. Now, the difference between also a slot player and a flanker is that, or a split end, is that slots often have to be really on the same page with their quarterback with a number of different coverage looks so that they're reading the correct zone drops or man looks, and so that they communicate well with their quarterback, because the middle of the field has a lot more complexities that you have to analyze, and you have to be quick at being able to analyze those things right off the bat and know where the quarterback's going to be throwing the ball based on what you guys see pre-snap and immediately post-snap. There's going to be a slight step or change of direction or a turn of the hips or, you know, how the player crouches, the defender crouches, or how he climbs or drops late, you know, just after the ball snapped. And the quarterback's looking at that, and he expects the receiver to look at it too and know, oh, they were giving me a man look, but now it's a zone look. Or these two players looked like they were in a zone look. They were going to cover me high-low, but what it actually looks like is this one guy's only covering me. The other guy's going to blitz. Those are the types of things that a slot player has to be very aware of. And that's why it's harder to play the slot in terms of mentally, your mental preparation and understanding of the game. You have to have a little bit higher degree of that compared to what you may have to have in a lot of offenses as a flanker or split end only. So, that's why it's always appealing when you see teams that say, well, he could play all three positions. That's appealing to them because that says this is a smart player. This is a guy who's shown intelligence, and the capacity to be able to develop into an all-around talent that they can use in multiple ways, which makes your offense less predictable. So that's a little bit about the receiver roles and what we look for from them. Oftentimes you're thinking about size and speed and physicality, as well as, just acumen for how they can play in the game, which is why, again, you look at a guy, we think about guys like Danny Woodhead or Devin Duvernay, possibly, guys who could play running back, or Austin Eckler, or guys who can play in the slot and are smart enough to read what the coverage is doing and to make those adjustments, but they have the versatility to be ultra quick between the tackles, physical enough to be able to handle contact, but at the same time, they can go up and win the ball against tight coverage, and they can run good enough routes in the short and intermediate range of the field that they're actually useful as a wide receiver. When you have that, and you have that kind of rapport with your quarterback, that's a special player, even if they turn out to be guys who physically you look at them and go, yeah, they're super quick, but they're not that big, they're not that, they're not that dynamic after the catch. And that's where people, get lost after fandom. The initial fandom is like, it's always about how athletic the player is, how many highlight-worthy plays the guy can make, as opposed to realizing that that third and sixth catch that the receiver made in the red zone, or the who was working out of the backfield as a running back, that he was able to process all that information so quickly that was in front of him to know where he was supposed to be. And the defense was trying to hide all that from him, and he was on the same page with his quarterback. That's what can make some of those players very special. All right, so let's talk a little bit about, that invisible thread, because really, to me, the more and more that I do this, the more I realize that scouting is about finding that invisible thread that runs through a player's game and ties together intuitive, compelling, and productive play. And so when we're talking about that, I was asked on a recent Dynasty podcast with, that really was about what is it that you've learned over the past, 14, 15 years that's really been important to your scouting. And one of those early lessons has been that it's not about the stats in terms of how the player performed. It's not about, tracking accuracy. I do a lot of this, but it's not solely about tracking their accuracy or how many yards were gained or how many touchdowns they had or how many blocks they succeeded in making. It's about, did they put themselves in a position where they could make a positive play or they could help a teammate make a positive play? And that's really the root of good scouting to me, is that, or of a good football player. A good football player puts himself or his teammates in a position to make a positive play with what he does physically, technically, conceptually, intuitively, on the football field. And in order to determine how that, whether that's the case, you really have to get into a lot of detail. You have to, because that ability to create those scenarios means that you're looking at the smallest details. And when you're looking at those smallest details, what pieces those together is that invisible thread, that it factor. I'm trying to find that it factor with every player. Do they have it? Do they not have it? Now, that doesn't mean that a player has to have that intuitive skill in order to become a good professional player and become a productive professional. There are a lot of players who they do one or two things really well. They're not extremely intuitive with a lot of their games, but what they are asked to do, they do great. They do their job well, and they're valuable members of your team, and they can be productive. You've seen people in your workplace that way who aren't intuitive at all about, you know, things outside their purview. But if you give them a task, they can do that task well, and they can be really productive for you. But then there's other people you know that they may not be the most productive person on your team. But they're someone that if you put them at five different roles, they could produce well enough to help your team in all five of those different roles. If they're asked to do something that may be unprecedented for your team, you're in a situation like many of us are right now in this pandemic, where maybe you're asked to take on more or different things than what you've done and what was in your role's definition. There are some people who really thrive, and there are some people who really struggle. You know, the people who thrive are the ones who are very good with that intuitive nature to piece disparate things together and to find productive, creative, outside-the-box solutions. And it's the same thing with football. So when we're talking about that invisible thread and how it ties skills together, you got to look at the details of the game. And so for me, you know, I've just created a new quarterback checklist. And this checklist now literally has, I would say it probably has over 170 points of criteria that I'm looking at for the 2021 season. You know, I mean, and that detail is important. You know, I mean, some of the things I've always had, you know, things like, you know, I've already, there's really not much change with play fakes or pump fakes or ball security. But I, you know, I'll give you some ideas of some of the things that I do look at in terms of the main categories, and then maybe we'll dive into some of the smaller ones. You know, so for instance, you know, play fakes, the exchange timing, extension variety, you know, I look at all that still. Pump fakes, you know, I want to grade the degree of the pump fake. And these are things that are, the point values are small. The weight for these things are small. But, you know, does he give at least a shoulder fake? Can he give a fake where there's more ball movement than just shoulder movement? Can he give a full fake with in terms of his arm motion? And also maybe, is there violence, range of motion? Does he do it with one hand? Those are things I look at in those various types of ways. Because, you know, again, you know, everyone does it differently, but at the same time, you want to see some sort of degrees of expert ability or degrees of facility with it. Ball security, you know, pretty much, you know, same stuff that I look at, but drops, you know, dropbacks. Are they dropped into a balanced and productive stance width? You know, before I would probably talk about more precisely, you know, what type of stance they needed to have, how wide it needed to be. Or, you know, instead now I'm starting to realize that it's not one size fits all. You know, talking with quarterback coaches, understanding that you want it to be, what is the outcome? You know, does the drop create a balanced stance? Is the stance width productive enough that they can throw with accuracy that's not inhibiting their accuracy? That's enough, you know, because if you start to prescribe how wide the stance has to be, then the next thing you know, you're applying something that may not work for another player, and you're canceling them out of your process. You're saying they don't do this well, and it might be that and a couple other things might be the difference between whether you're going to take him or somebody else, and you may have just canceled him out unnecessarily out of your pool. You know, and again, it comes down, you know, people might say, well, how does a drop width really going to make that much of a difference? Well, again, you know, if you're in a specific type of offense where you're going to drop 3, 5, and 7 steps in that offense versus one that maybe just runs a pistol, if you have quarterbacks who, you know, what you want to do is narrow the field of quarterbacks that you're going to study, and, you know, for that particular team, you're going to narrow it down to players that maybe you feel like with their drops, they can execute a variety of drops and get into that a balanced stance, you know. And if you're defining that stance in a way that is too narrow in terms of a definition, you may be losing players from your list that you shouldn't be exiting out. So, you know, other things that I look at, you know, with releases, I've been adding things with footwork, like is the midline of the back foot aligned with the target? You know, again, do they achieve a productive and efficient weight transfer? Again, it's not a specific note about the weight transfer as much as it is, are they getting the job done? You know, talk about the quickness of the arm motion, the compactness of the arm motion. Can they vary the arm motion? These are all things that I looked at in the release, along with a balanced release stance. And then really one of the big areas that I've changed a lot is decision-making. You know, now I'm starting to look at things like, you know, I've done this over the years, but I've really started to define these more, you know, decisions is like the quarterback's version of running back vision. You know, vision is kind of a catch-all term. For quarterbacks, the coverage, decisions is a catch-all term because decisions accounts for how a player reads coverage. How controlled is their aggression? Do they have aggression, and do they have a level of control with it where they don't get reckless? Kind of that balance between being aggressive and being reckless. They need to be closer to the aggressive side of that line and not spill over to the reckless side. You know, their timing, you know, and that includes their anticipation of routes breaking open, and then also being able to execute to the speed of reaction. So, for instance, you know, being able to deliver the ball in rhythm with the route progression plan, you can, lots of quarterbacks do that in practice where basically no one's really covering their receiver. But what about when they're in a tight window against coverage and that defender turns his chest to the boundary, or has his chest turned to the boundary as the receiver's at the top of his stem and about to break the opposite way? Well, the defender may be playing tight coverage at that moment, but as a quarterback, you have to be able to operate the speed, you know, that speed of instinct to be able to understand that the leverage is set up in such a way by the defender that the receiver is going to be able to break open. That the receiver will break open because it's impossible for the defender to turn from the sideline back to the inside in time at the point that you're looking at the top of that stem. So in essence, it may not look open, but based on the mechanics of how things work, it is open. And you need to be able to see that and react to it. A guy like Alex Smith needed confirmation for his receiver to actually break and show that he was open, and then as a result, he gave time for the defender to turn and recover and make the play. Whereas if you actually see that leverage point and begin your throw at that point, it's going to be impossible for the defender to catch up if you place it exactly where it needs to be as the receiver makes his break, rather than affording the defender time to use his speed and quickness to be able to recover. So, you know, that's part of timing and anticipation and playing the speed of reaction. Other things I look for with decision-making, risk management. Do they throw the ball away to avoid sacks? Do they make judicious checkdowns? You know, oftentimes these things come at field position moments, you know, in the red zone or deep in their own territory where a sack has a lot worse consequences, you know, inside your own 18, down by 3, and they sack you and you fumble the ball and they score and now they're up by 10. As opposed to if you held on to the ball too long at the 45 of your opponent and you get sacked, and then basically if you end up fumbling the ball, it's the equivalent of a good punt return, but they still have a good ways to go. They're not in the red zone and you're not giving up at least an instant 3, if not an easy 7. You know, so these are things that, you know, risk management's important. Adjustments, you know, are they looking at the correct information pre-snap and post-snap? Do they know where to look based on the pre-snap alignment of where do I need to see a defender make a slight adjustment based on this look that may offer the difference between them showing me a man look and actually playing zone, or are they showing me a man look on this side and it's actually going to be zone on the opposite side? You know, different types of things like that you need to be able to notice pre-snap. Same thing with post-snap. Is it post-snap looks? Does the defender charge, the safety charge up the alley upfield to cover a receiver tightly when it looked like he was playing off? We know that then again, you know, we see that that may offer a key to what the defense is actually doing after, you know, hiding what they were doing pre-snap pretty well. So, you know, do they, are they given line or audible responsibilities in terms of, you know, blocking with the line or in terms of what they do, you know, with being able to change a play? You know, so those are some of the things that we start looking at. And you can see there's a lot of minutiae here because, you know, I have a 100-point scale for quarterbacks on this checklist, but I have well over 100 points that I'm looking at. So some of these things are weighted more than others. And some of these things are just like things that you would assume that all NFL quarterbacks are able to do to some degree. Those things tend to have more value and weight than the things, those little details that may be the difference between them being great and them being good. You know, being good's more common, so the point values are going to be higher. The smaller differences between players are the most valuable, but there tend to be the lowest point values as well. So that's why you're going to see players, you know, you have a lot more players who are going to score between 75 and 80, but you're going to have fewer players who are going to score between 81 and 90, you know, and that's, and the higher you get between, say, there's going to be a lot fewer players who score between 80 to 85 than are they're going to be scoring between 86 to 90 because those smaller point values make that much more of a difference. And it's, you know, and that's just kind of how it is. It's that small, that narrow difference between good and excellence. And that's what I'm looking at here, and the checklists reflect that. So, you know, I look at all sorts of different types of accuracy types. You know, I'm looking at things like, you know, how they sense pressure, manage pressure, whether they have platform accuracy without pressure, whether they're able to make platform throws with pressure in their, you know, bearing down on them, as well as opposite hash throws, you know, with and without pressure, mobile throws on the move with and without pressure, off platform throws where they're, you know, maybe fading away or throwing on the, you know, throwing where they've had to leap or jump or throw off of one foot, you know, that type of thing with or without pressure. And then I'm also looking at how they run. You know, some players running is an asset for them. For other players, it's, you know, they may be able to move the chains. Some may be able to break away. Some are guys that basically, if they can get back to the line of scrimmage, they've had a successful run. Scrambling, you know, to me, scrambling's different than running. You know, a guy like Marcus Mariota can run, but he's not much of a scrambler, if you ask me. I mean, can they, and to me, I'm looking at things like how many points of pressure arriving in the pocket can they buy time against at one point? You know, a guy like Mariota may buy time well against one point of pressure, but put two different points of pressure coming in succession at him, and that's more difficult for him. Whereas maybe a guy like Joe Burrow can handle 3 points of pressure in the college game and still be able to maneuver into an open spot and get rid of the ball fast. So I talk about also extending plays in and outside the pocket, as well as plays, you know, as well as playing, you know, just solely inside the pocket. Some guys are very good at being able to work inside the pocket well, but they can't break outside of it. You know, so those are a lot of things that I'm looking at, you know, in order to do this. And I, you know, I'll tell you right now, when it comes to where I place the most weight, you know, I place the most weight on decision making. You know, for me, for quarterbacks, the most important thing is, do they make strong decisions based on, again, you know, reading coverage, controlled aggression, timing and anticipation, risk management, adjustments. You know, those are things that, to me, are the top skills, the most important things that make a difference. After that, then I want to see a guy who can basically, you know, deliver accurately on platform with no pressure. You know, that's a baseline skill. You got to at least be able to do that in the NFL. Drop back, plant your feet, be balanced, throw the ball. If you can't make good decisions and you can't, you know, you don't have to be a perfect decision maker or an extraordinary decision maker. You just have to have a baseline of good decisions, and you have to be able to throw, you know, with your feet on the ground on platform. If you can do that, you have a shot of being a good college player, and probably, depending on your other skills, that increases your chances of being in the NFL. Your release obviously has to be good. It has to be something that doesn't get in the way. It has to be quick enough. It has to be, efficient enough, something that isn't going to hurt your arm, you're in terms of doing over and over again. Drops, same thing. You don't have to execute every type of drop, but can you show that the drops that you make set up your stance so that you can release the ball and throw it accurately? Got to be there. And depending on the different type of offense that you may go to, drops can have more or less importance, depending on, whether it's a pistol offense or whether you're going to be dropping back from center often and executing a complete play action game of 3, 5, and 7 steps. Sensing pressure and managing pressure. Both are equal weight, in my opinion. Same with on-platform throws against pressure. All those are very important. I give them almost equal weight, and they're in the top half of, my priorities in terms of point values on this list. So you get a sense of what I'm looking at here. At the bottom of the list, without going into the whole thing, the bottom of the list, give you an example, throwing off platform versus pressure. That's the difference between maybe a great player, and an average starter. Their ability to throw on the move under pressure, same thing. Opposite hash pressure throws, their running ability. Those are things in the bottom half, because those are the things that maybe differentiate great players who can do all the top half stuff that I just mentioned versus players who can only do, the bottom half. And so that's kind of where I'm at when it comes to, say, quarterback. And we'll talk more, maybe further down the line about what I look for with running backs and wide receivers and tight ends as I'm doing this. I've revamped all of this for the 2021 season, and it's based on work that I've been doing for a few years, making notes, observing things, adding things in, and kind of experimenting with it on the side, where it may not have always counted in my evaluations for the current year's work, but it counted in terms of, me wanting to develop, and move forward and learn about the game and make sure that I felt good enough about the criteria from there. So that's that. So let's go on to some projections here. Talk about some fun stuff for 2021 or 2020 season, and about players who kind of stood out to me in terms of where I've projected them right now. And these will probably change as the season unfolds for sure. But let's start off with Todd Gurley. This is a projection that stood out to me because now he's in Atlanta. And I have him at this point, at a number where I feel like that he's still going to be a starting running back in the NFL in terms of production. I have him right now at about 240 attempts, 981 yards, for just under a 4.1 yards per carry average, 9 touchdowns, and then 55 targets for 36 catches, 287 yards, at just under 8 yards per catch for 2 touchdowns. That puts him in the range of about 229 fantasy points for PPR leagues. And when you think about guys who had that, 229 points when it comes to, the running back position for PPR, 229 points will put you roughly at about the 12th or 13th player. And Gurley was at 221 points last year as the 14th ranked PPR running back. So I don't see much of a change for him. That's a far different, people are going to look at it and say, well, he's gone. He's not the same player he once was. Well, that's true. That's why he's no longer a dominant number one, number two, number three back, one of those elite guys. This is the difference. He still has good vision. He can still make that first cut. He still has enough acceleration. He's still strong. He still can catch the football. In Atlanta, you put him in an offense where the thing that makes a difference for me is you understand that this Atlanta offense has a really strong offensive line now, and it's getting it kind of was out of the mix last year, and you could see that early in the season when the two rookies they had, McGarry and Lindstrom, weren't in the game, that this offensive line struggled. But as they got in, the run game got better, and I think a second, year two in this offensive unit, this offensive line is going to be better. Gurley's going to play reasonably well. I think he's going to get the majority of the carries, because when you look at a guy like Ito Smith and Brian Hill, they're guys that I have projected for 110 carries total. So that you have, you know, Gurley with 240, Ito Smith with 55, Brian Hill with 55, and then even Kadre Olison, who I like, maybe playing that Malcolm Brown role. He's at 24 attempts right now. So when you look at those guys, I think there's going to be a total of maybe, you know, 15 touchdowns in the rushing game, with Gurley getting five of them. So, you know, it stands out to me, because I think people are going to look at that and say, are you still rating Todd Gurley? The Rams got rid of him. You're still going to put him in the top 15? And I think he is. I think he's a guy right off the bat now I look at that's going to have an opportunity to still do that, be in the bottom portion of the top 15 of running backs. All right, so who's another guy that stands out? Matt Stafford. You know, I had a really nice projection. I had really high projections for him last year, thinking that he would get healthy and stay healthy, but he had another back injury. This is one that I may end up having to change down the line, and I may have some regrets about that, or may have to change it. But, you know, I have him right now at a point where I think he's going to get close to 4,700 yards passing, over 30 yards, over 30 touchdowns, 33 touchdowns, 12 interceptions. I think he's going to throw at about a 65% rate, because you look at this team and Galladay and Jones. I mean, Jones still plays well. Galladay is coming into his own. You have reliable players like Amendola, maybe Geronimo Allison if Quintez Cephus doesn't beat him out. And I think Cephus is a really good player. And TJ Hawkinson, who dropped a lot of balls early on, I think you're going to see Hawkinson really start to emerge this year. And I'm counting on him to be able to do that. I think he's going to count for 7 of those 33 touchdowns, whereas I think Galladay and Jones can account for about 18 of them themselves. I think they're both going to have decent years, where Galladay leads in receiving and touchdowns, but Jones isn't that far behind, you know, and maybe even a little bit more efficient player, you know, in terms of targets to catches. So, you know, and then you throw in the run game and you realize that, you know, Johnson's a good receiver. DeAndre Swift's a good receiver. I think those guys can account for about 70 targets between the two if they can both stay healthy. And if they don't, one of them might be able to get 70 targets. And we may look at about 50, you know, 45, 50 receptions for these guys for close to 500 yards total and a few touchdowns on their own. So, you know, Stafford, to me, with the offensive line improving, as long as he's healthy and the back injuries he had aren't debilitating, they're not like, you know, disc issues. They're more, you know, bone issues that healed. And if the bones healed and healed sufficiently enough, hopefully, you know, we can get, you know, some quality play out of him at this point. You know, another guy who, you know, strikes me as being, you know, standing out in a way that may not be as positive as Aaron Jones. Jones had, you know, a high touchdown total last year. He had a strong season, but, you know, he wasn't able to stay fully healthy. So, again, they added A.J. Dillon. So, I see this as a three-headed committee right now. I think Aaron Jones is going to lead the committee, but I don't even think he's going to get 200 attempts this year. I think he's going to be closer to 180, maybe 175, somewhere in that range. You know, just under 900 yards. I think he'll have a good yards per carry average. And I have him rated at almost just under 5 and still scoring 8 touchdowns. And he's going to still lead this unit in targets as well. I think he'll probably have 35 receptions, you know, for about 300 yards, a little over that. Still combined for 11 total touchdowns. And he'll be a top 20 back, I think, in this, you know, in leagues or close to it, score close to that. But I think that, you know, Jamal Williams is so good as a receiver, so good as a blocker, that they're going to continue to use him as a pass pro guy who can then filter out of the backfield when he's not needed and be able to get open for Aaron Rodgers. That kind of ability to make those decisions is that hidden skill, that kind of hidden thread about a player that maybe fantasy people miss out on, and they go, well, why don't they just put another guy in the game? Because he's not as athletic. You know, Williams doesn't have as much burst, and he's just not as exciting or electric. Well, part of the reason is there are a few backs out there who are good at being able to pick up blocks the way Williams can, but also know when he can, you know, get out of the backfield and find an opening for his quarterback and be able to get himself open and be a friendly target. and he does that well. And I think A.J. Dillon, you know, and you still understand that Williams is a good downhill runner. You know, he's a thumper. He's not, you know, he doesn't have the quickness that Jones has, but he's a guy, too, that to keep the offense less predictable, you're going to let him run the ball. He's going to be able to, you know, do some good in the inside the 20s. He's a good change of pace back. You know, he's a good zone runner. He makes good decisions. He doesn't break them wide open, you know, and that's the difference between he and Jones. If he could break the runs wide open, he'd probably be the lead back in this offense and the feature back, but he wasn't able to do that. And so you're looking at kind of a guy that people describe as a plotter, but still an efficient runner for what he does. You know, A.J. Dillon, look at him. I think he's going to have a strong start. I think he'll lead this team in yards per carry average. I think he's going to be just under 5 yards per carry. I think he's going to have as many touchdowns as Aaron Jones, but just fewer carries. It's going to take him a little bit more time to really earn that job. It's going to take him a year. And I think he'll get targets in the passing game. Not as many as Williams, not as many as Jones, but it'll be a substantial number that you'll realize that the writing's on the wall for Aaron Jones, that he won't be here in 2021. All right. So another guy moving forward, Deshaun, let's see. Let's talk about T.Y. Hilton. You know, T.Y. Hilton's a guy that when you look at his game, he's one of those players that has the speed and the ability to win against tight coverage that you could see how Phillip Rivers might target him in a way that he's often targeted his big receivers. You know, he's also a guy that you could see where maybe, because he can play in the slot and play outside, that maybe, you know, Rivers targets him with the volume of Keenan Allen. Or maybe he's more of a souped-up Travis Benjamin who can be used more in that split-end role and be able to go deep but also run the timing routes that you're looking for. So there's a lot of variation with what T.Y. Hilton can offer. Right now, I've got him as the target leader, you know, in this offense, and with being probably their best deep threat target too, and having Paris Campbell being more the Keenan Allen type of guy. But I could see how that switches up. So I'm right now I have, you know, Hilton at 110 targets, 72 receptions, 1,070 yards, and 7 touchdowns. And, you know, that's obviously a great, you know, that's a nice look for him in terms of what his production can be. But again, a lot of that's going to be variable to me based on what Paris Campbell and Michael Pittman and Zach Pascal's roles are going to be. You know, another guy that kind of comes to mind for me, Clyde Edwards-Helaire. You know, a lot of people are going to project him to be by far the leading rusher in this outfit. I have it more conservative to start. I have it more as a 2.5 headed backfield. I'll put it that way. The first, you know, there's Edwards-Helaire. The other head is Damian Williams, and the other maybe half a head there is Darwin Thompson, who even the running back coaches in Kansas City are like, don't forget about this guy. He's gotten better and better every time we watched him. We're excited about him. Some of that may be a confidence booster to Thompson because they feel like they don't want him to lose his confidence, you know, with Edwards-Helaire and possibility of Edwards-Helaire getting hurt and then Thompson not being ready. But I have Edwards-Helaire at about 150 attempts for 665 yards, which is a nice 4.4 yards per carry average, 5 touchdowns, and then 45 targets. He'll be the target leader for 34 catches, 245 yards, and 2 touchdowns. It's not a huge number. 167 points in PPR. You're looking at a guy right now who would be your running back 27 based on last year. That's pretty low for a guy people are drafting so high. But let's remember, you know, I will probably change this as it goes on, but I want to take the conservative track to see how much Edwards-Helaire is learning about the offense and slowly build it upwards as opposed to assuming he's going to be the guy and then having to account for everybody else. Because I think Damian Williams still is going to be taking a fair bit of touches. I still think Darwin Thompson will have a role. I think Darrell Williams will still have a bit of a role. And when you split it up in that way, 4 different ways, and the way that this team, you know, gets its yardage and looking at the past 3 years of yardage production for running and catching, you know, the pie isn't as hefty if you're going to split it 4 ways. So just kind of wanted to give you that heads up that, you know, this is a guy that I'm going to slowly be adding on to if he demonstrates those skills right, you know, early on, that they feel like they can trust him and pass pro, they can trust him in the receiving game, or they're going to use him more in the goal line. If they're going to use him more inside the red zone, his numbers will probably increase from there. So there are more guys I wanted to get to, but the hour's coming, you know, to a close here. So I just want to thank everybody for listening. I hope everyone's staying safe. And even if you feel like, some of you listening out there feel like this isn't really that serious, be considerate of others. It doesn't take too much to actually just take a safeguard in the same way that you may be an expert driver and maybe you can handle high speeds and work away and keep people safe. But there's a reason why the law says, slow down when there's construction on the highway. You know, think of this as construction on the highway right now. You know, wear a mask, take precautions, even if it doesn't turn out that the rate of infection isn't going to infect you, isn't going to be affect you. You're young, you're healthy, whatever you think it is, just for being considerate. It doesn't take much to be considerate. So thanks again for listening, and we will be back next week, probably with Russ Landy or Mark Schofield or maybe another guest.